You're listening to Screen Heroes on the Heroes Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome back to Screen Heroes, your film podcast on the Heroes Podcast Network. I am your host, Derek, and I have with me my two regular, lovely, longtime hosts, Ryan.
Hi.
And Ray.
Hello.
Hello, hello. Welcome back, everybody. This is episode 224 of the show as we get closer to our five-year anniversary of the series, which is pretty exciting. So obviously a lot going on tonight. We're recording this on Tuesday. It is election day, so you know, we're trying to distract a bit from all of the stress of the real world, and we'll be talking about 1996's The Rock. We decided to talk about this kind of in honor of the passing of Sean Connery at the age of 90 a few days ago. It's a Michael Bay film starring Sean Connery, Nick Cage, and Ed Harris, among some other fan favorites. So we'll be talking about that after the break. But first, our news segment. Lots of news to talk about, but most of it is kind of in the DC realm. It turns out that was not intentional or anything. But we'll start with just kind of a fun, like, dream project thing. And it's because I think Ryan wants to talk maybe a little bit about it, but it has to do with the original Ninja Turtles movie.
Mm-hmm.
No visual response from Ryan, but the director, Steve Barron, has talked a little bit about how he wishes he could make a sequel to the original, and kind of, you know, the way a lot of franchises have revived themselves recently. You had Bill and Ted Face the Music. We're getting Ghostbusters Afterlife next year. You've had a few franchises like Terminator erase other sequels. And it sounds like, you know, he would love to do that. Ryan, what are your thoughts?
And not only that, he also has already talked to Brian Henson about it in Henson Studios. So, you know, the fact that it wasn't just like he wants to do it, like there's actually been conversations about it. So that's cool. But he kept using the word reboot in these quotes, which I thought was weird, because he clearly doesn't want a reboot. He wants a sequel to the original movies. I kind of hope that if he does that, then they cut out the third one, and that just never happened. But yeah, I mean, it would be awesome. I think most 30 somethings at this point have very fond memories of that movie, at least the first one. And you know, we've talked about it on here. It still holds up pretty well, especially considering it was a comic book movie, you know, from that time period. But absolutely. Yeah, it's very exciting.
Yeah, we talked about it actually back in March for the 30th anniversary of the original film. So you can check out that episode. Ray, do you have any thoughts? Do you want to see a direct sequel to the first two-ish live action Ninja Turtle movies?
Yeah, it'd be a lot of fun. Those movies were a ton of fun, and for the most part they hold up. It's not just like nostalgia glasses. They're still really entertaining. They are what they are, and I adore that. You know, it's not just me rewatching them, going back and being like, ugh, what was I thinking as a child? It's seriously me looking back at me like, yeah, this is great. This is fun. So I would love that. I think it would be just a blast to see puppetry again and the foam suits, characters that are just all over the place, and kind of broaden their world a bit. I know the movies just kind of barely touched the tip of what the TV show and comic books have done, so I would be down for it.
And on top of that, there was a comic book series that just came out that's very cool. If they want to, you know, gritty reimaginings of these things are like the big popular thing right now, but there's a storyline called The Last Ronin, which is basically where three of the four turtles have been killed, and the one brother that's left uses all the weapons of his fallen brothers to try and get revenge for the death of his brothers. And something like that would translate really well into the gritty reboot or gritty sequel kind of landscape that we have in movies right now. I don't know that the world is ready for that dark of a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles storyline, but man, I think the 30-somethings would come out for that, for sure.
I think they could easily make that an animated show, something like the DC was doing. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. But
they could definitely pull that off. Some of their weirder stories, some of their scarier or more intense stories, definitely.
Yeah, I don't think they'd take that chance in live action. But oh, no. Man, that would be awesome. No. Get Henson involved in something that dark. Jeez, that'd
I don't
be
know.
Sweet.
The new Dark Crystal Age of Resistance was pretty dark. And I mean, the first film is also dark in a lot of parts. I mean, if anything, it's only held back because of some of the technological restraints at the time that they wouldn't have anymore, you know? So
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it doesn't have to be rated R necessarily. I think it could be like a hard PG-13. You know, we've seen some of the more modern blockbusters hit, you know, pretty hard on PG-13. I think they could pull it off.
Yeah. It's not like they need nudity or like a ton of cursing. It would be mostly just violence, I would think.
Right.
Yeah,
and exactly. It would give them a chance to really show off some various martial arts, which I don't see a reason why the turtles need to be just experts in one martial arts. I think they would be experts in quite a few.
Well, especially nowadays where MMA is the big thing and combining multiple different martial arts styles to be the best of all of these things, you know. Yeah, that would be, banking on that popularity would be cool.
Now, here's a question. You know, we all love what the original Turtles looked like, the practical suits and everything, but would you be up for a mocap situation if it looked as good as like War for Planet of the Apes?
No.
Really? Yeah. Not even
not if it's a continuation of the original? No, absolutely not. It would be like if they said, we're going to do CGI Dark Crystal. I mean, the original,
that's fair.
Much of the character was from the characters being practical, you know. So
well, what if it was just a one-off Ronin story, but done?
I'd still go see it. Like, I'm being a jerk, but I would go see it for sure still, even with mocap. I would just be less happy with it.
Gotcha. Okay, Ray, any opinion there?
I don't see a huge problem with that, to be completely honest. There's pros and cons of each. The biggest pro to doing mocap would mean getting to see more intense martial arts. Because obviously with a big foam suit on, you're a bit limited. So that would be really the only benefit I could, or the huge one up, the only reason why I would say, yeah, do it. But if they're not going to...
years of costume building technology since then, though. I mean, look, now Batman can turn his head.
In
so
30 years,
head,
yeah, Batman can
the
turn
turtles
his head.
Can do martial arts, right?
Yes, exactly.
Oof.
Sorry for interrupting, right. Rachel.
No, you're fine. It's, you know, it's what you guys do.
You're used to it.
Right.
Ouch. Anything more on the Ninja Turtles?
No.
So more about the Ray Fisher Warner Brothers Justice League situation has come to life. And man, things are complicated and messy in this. So now, first off, a spokesperson for Whedon has come out and I'm paraphrasing, basically said that the allegations are false. I want to hit on that because it's not Whedon who's saying it. It's a spokesperson who's saying it, and Fisher is really put himself out there, and I can appreciate the position that he's in. But probably most importantly, something that's kind of come to light is some aspects of Whedon's Justice League cut that I guess should have been obvious to us that I never personally noticed. And it has to do with really from the cut material and the reshoots. A lot of the stuff that was removed focused on actors who are people of color. And those were the roles that were either eliminated completely or severely reduced. And this even includes Ray Fisher's Cyborg story, where he says only one real shot, like 30 seconds on the rooftop, is from the original version of the film. And even at one of the actors' skin tone was lightened up and changed in post. guys, I'm sure you have strong opinions about this whole situation, and I've been talking a lot, so somebody jump in.
No, you're good. So I think the more stuff that comes out about the Justice League set with Whedon, the more accurate it is. Fisher has had multiple people kind of corroborate his stories that seem just a bit more, I guess, reliable than Whedon, but it's still a he said, she said situation, unfortunately. And I think only time's gonna tell. But the biggest, I guess the biggest sign is that Whedon's not speaking for himself. He's ducking around, letting WB personal assistants or spokespeople speak for him. So that to me screams guilt of at least some percentage.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about it is the color changing of the skin. If it was like making a black person white, that's fucked up, man. I mean, there's no way around that. But I mean, there is a lot of stuff that they do in post, that, you know, different lighting and different shots and things like that. And I'm worried that he's just going out and saying this without really knowing what happened, because that when it was in the article before they deleted it, it said that he heard from someone that Whedon did this. And so, yikes. You know, yeah, it's, I mean, I don't know if that, if purely how he said it is what happened, then that's probably pretty messed up. But it's one of those things where I'm like 85% with Fisher, and like 15% of me is like, I don't know. Like, there's a lot of stuff that seems fishy from his side too, that, you know, is more like he's just complaining because he didn't get enough screen time or something like that. But, you know, yeah, cutting out black actor or actors of color is totally messed up, and it's not something that I noticed either when we've talked about this in the past. So that was definitely something interesting that came from this.
Yeah, it's definitely a difficult situation, because I absolutely believe that some stuff happened.
Absolutely, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how much stuff happened. And, you know, Whedon having a spokesperson speak for him is a complicated situation, right? Because it kind of gives that air of he's being protective because he did something wrong. But that doesn't necessarily mean that. It might also mean that he's being protective because he doesn't want to accidentally say the wrong thing and incriminate himself when that's not what happened.
Or that, right? Warner Brothers is saying, shut your damn mouth.
Sure.
And this, right, is what's going to happen. So, you know,
people get heated and people can say things that are taken out of context or are in the heat of the moment that may not reflect the actual events that occurred. Right. And so it's a difficult situation. It's not apples to apples, and it makes it seem unfair, because it seems like Whedon has all this help and protection and Fisher's like out on a ledge somewhere by himself. And then there's the color correction thing, right? Like, Whedon didn't necessarily oversee all of that. There are people whose job it is to do those things on large scale blockbusters like this. And he may have not studied it to that level, right? Like, Snyder stuff is all colorized in different ways too, but he takes an incredible hands-on approach to every film he's ever done. So I believe that there isn't a single shot in a Snyder film that he didn't personally approve every change to. I don't know.
There's also the fact that I think that the article said that that Snyder was shooting on film, whereas Whedon was shooting digital. And so there's definitely has to be color correction between the two of those to make them work too. So yeah, there's a lot of things that could have gone into that. And it makes it tough to judge that comment, you know?
Agreed.
Whedon is notoriously a little lazy when it comes to his editing too. If you look at Serenity and Avengers Age of Ultron, there are numerous little mistakes that he ignores and that could be fixed in post. So,
like the earpieces?
Yeah.
Avengers.
Oh, I mean, the one that stands out every time for me, and now it just makes me angry, is all the punching bags that Cap goes through, like back and forth. Some have duct tape and some don't. And every time I just stare at it now and I'm like, stop it, stop it, stop it.
Fair. That's fair. Yeah. So I think the moral of the story here is it's a very difficult situation. And I think something definitely happened, but I don't know what, and I don't know whose fault those things are if they did happen necessarily. So Fisher is still out there. He's trying to get his side of things heard, and we're going to have to continue to wait and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right. Well, moving on in the DC realm, we got a bunch of more information about the upcoming HBO Max Green Lantern series, which I'm still not convinced is going to exist, but hey, we'll see. So we had already talked about how they're going to have Guy Gardner, Alan Scott, Jessica Cruz, and Simon Boz. And we mentioned a little bit about how some of that's confusing because Alan Scott is from a totally different time period and a different version of the Green Lanterns. And that is an interesting situation. Well, it turns out that it's actually probably more simple than we thought. The series is going to exist in multiple time periods.
The Witcher.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, basically. Yeah.
Exactly.
One of which is the 40s, which lines up with Alan Scott's time period. The 80s supposedly will focus on Guy Gardner, which means I'm assuming what they're going to consider present day will focus on Jessica Cruz and Simon Boz, which works out pretty well for me as a Green Lantern comic book fan, because that kind of shakes out to when those different lanterns were focused on Earth. So I'm cool with it.
Yeah, absolutely. That sounds just fine, splitting it. I hope they do a bit better of telling the story than what The Witcher did. I know a lot of people, even people who knew the story ahead of time, were having trouble following that. So if they can find a way to cut it better, then yeah, that works for me.
I think it'll be easier with this because the problem with The Witcher was that everything looked like old medieval stuff, you know, no matter what time period it was. Whereas this, in the 40s, the fashion was much different than it was in the 80s and it was in the, you know, newer time period. So I think it'll make it much easier to differentiate, you know, the cars, basically everything looks different. So hopefully, if it's not all in outer space, I mean, I guess we don't know.
Right.
But if it's all in outer space, that could still be a problem, but we'll see. I guess I'm hoping that it doesn't all take place in outer space. I'd like to see something a little more grounded.
Yeah, I'm with you though. If anything that takes place on Earth should be pretty clear. And I mean, just from my perspective, it's not that hard to throw tiny little title things on the screen that
say, really not, you know,
Kansas City, Missouri, 1995, like whatever, you know, like it doesn't ruin the show for anybody to do that. And me, for so I watched the first season of The Witcher. I have not played the games. I have not read the books. I was really confused about when certain things are happening from time to time, because it's not clear that there are different time periods, especially early on.
We have multiple characters that don't age, so that makes it way harder too.
Yep, exactly. So that was very confusing to me, and I had to like ask Ray, like, wait a minute, when is this happening? Like, just throw a year up there.
I eventually had to draw him a timeline.
Or, you know, like, at least like make up some ages, right? And there's three ages, and this is when they, that way you don't have to give me an exact date. I get it if you don't want to, you know, pigeonhole yourself like that. I understand, because then people will complain that, you know, Spider-Man Homecoming doesn't line up with the rest of the MCU. I get you.
Yeah. You still remember that, Derek.
I know. It's funny. Another aspect to the Green Lantern show, yeah, that
I was thinking, Rachel, it's not that funny.
Is very interesting. Look, you want to go there?
No, just continue, please. For
love, I was trying to. So there are reports that the main character of the Green Lantern series might be a half-human, half-alien, black woman Green Lantern, which is very interesting because that could be the character from a series called Far Sector, which is a relatively new look at Green Lantern. It's pretty different from the previous Green Lantern series. And so it's very interesting that they may be trying to hit like the entire timeline of Green Lanterns in one show. On one hand, it's a super cool prospect and very exciting to think about. on the other, that's incredibly ambitious for a property they have not successfully adapted to live action yet, with a controversially mixed review, not so great movie, and a completely canceled other movie. So I don't know. I'm trying to be cautiously optimistic at this point.
That's all you can do. It's still really early. I mean,
it is. You're right.
So a lot of this news is to be taken with a grain of salt. You know, there's questionable sources reporting some of it, and you know, we're grasping at whatever we can because we're all excited for it. But yeah, it's important to keep in mind that it's still really early on in the development process. So anything that we hear now could change easily.
Yeah, absolutely. I think really at this point, all I want to know is, where is Hal and John? There's no way in this world they don't exist when everybody else does.
Where is the sentient math equation?
I don't care if they're not the focus. I just want to know where they are. So,
well, I mean, one thing they could do to keep them out of the way, you know, Hal runs the core. He's core leader in the comics at certain times. They could just keep him on Oa, right? And then he's kind of kept out of the way.
Yeah.
John's a harder one to kind of pin down. He's my favorite Lantern, so I'm also a little bummed that he's not one of the people listed. And like Guy is, like, I find Guy kind of grating. So
Guy is the worst.
Yeah, but you're also getting a show with four different versions of your favorite characters. So I mean,
absolutely,
it seems like you're kind of complaining when there's other people that had their show, their one of their favorite characters in a show, and then it gets canceled after one episode airs. Because of budget reasons. So yeah.
Hey, look, the show hasn't even been produced yet, so who knows if it's ever going to see the light of day. You know, all I mean is, I feel like, you know, the CW had the perfect opportunity to do a Jon Stewart-esque version of Green Lantern with Diggle, and they missed that opportunity completely, which is a bummer to me. And now they had another opportunity, and they're like, nah. So it's just like, come on, guys.
Maybe he'll cameo.
Maybe. All right. Well, moving on, we got one more news piece before we take a break, and it's going to talk about AMC theaters. So, of course, COVID has created a complication for the movie industry, and most new releases have either gone to digital or pushed until future years. Black Widow, of course, has now moved. There's talks of James Bond 25 being moved to a streaming service. Well, AMC has, for their third quarter, posted a over $900 million loss, over 90% drop in revenue. It's pretty bad news at this point. AMC is essentially like looking for money. They are maybe going to try and do a stock sell to try and make up some of that. It's kind of hard to say at this point, but AMC Theaters is not looking good. And mm-hmm. if you're one of the people who had A-list, you basically have until the beginning of December to decide if you want to reactivate that or not. So just kind
of. Will you guys be reactivating that?
No, we will not.
No.
Okay. So just, this is probably a bit of a two business question for you guys for this podcast, but if they did a stock sale, would you guys be interested in buying their stock? Well, it's probably the lowest that it'll ever be.
I mean, if I had money.
How much do you believe
around?
In AMC is what I'm saying. If I gave you $1,000, would you spend that $1,000 on AMC stock?
No.
Not today, but I think if it got as low as some of the estimates are saying, I think I probably would.
So because you believe that they'll bounce back from this?
I believe that if they don't, then I don't know that any other chain
theaters
will either. And it might just be independent theaters at that point, which there I'm sure there are some people out there that are cheering to that notion. But I think AMC is owned by the largest theater company in the entire world. And if they can't survive this, I don't know if any other chain can.
That's fair.
So that's my perspective. But I'm not going back to the theaters in December. And that makes me hope that Bond goes to streaming services and Wonder Woman pushes. But, you know, we'll have to wait and see.
Or even better, Wonder Woman goes to streaming services so I can watch it.
I mean, that would be cool too. No complaint
here.
Because
I need it in my eye holes right now.
Yeah, no complaints. And Free Guy, I would like Free Guy to go to streaming services
too.
As well.
Yeah.
Like, I want to see all of these movies. Like, and that's something I hope people understand is like, we, the three of us, like used to see upwards of like two dozen movies a year. And
yeah, easily 1 to 2 a month,
right?
Just for the podcast.
For the podcast.
Let alone what we wanted to see in our own personal. Yeah.
So this has been, you know, this has been hard. We Ray and I, the last movie we saw in theaters was Birds of Prey, I think.
Same with me.
Right? Was there anything else that we saw that time of year?
No.
So it's, you know, it's been slow from that standpoint. But all right. Well, we're way past how much I wanted to talk about news today. So we are going to take a short break. And when we come back, we will be talking 1996's The Rock, starring Sean Connery and Nicolas Cage. We will be right back. All right, let's do this. Let's talk Michael Bay's The Rock. So Sean Connery passed away this past week at the age of 90, and we don't get to talk about him a lot on the show. We did coincidentally discuss one of his movies, his last movie, earlier this year, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. But other than that, I'm not sure that we've ever covered anything else that he's ever been in. And so I thought this would be a good opportunity to cover something. And what better movie than one that also stars Nick Cage, Ryan's favorite actor ever?
It's true. Top five for sure.
And yeah, so we're going to talk The Rock. The Rock came out in 1996, budget of about $75 million. It made over $330 million worldwide at the box office. So a success, at least by 90s standards. The film stars an array of people, which is pretty cool. You know, you've got the main three, of course, Sean Connery, Nick Cage, and Ed Harris. But there's also a few smaller roles in there. John C. McGinley and Tony Todd are two of my personal favorites. Anybody else have a favorite in there that you saw?
Michael
in the
Bean.
There you go.
No.
There you go. No, Michael Bean. No John Connor.
Nah.
No Hicks.
He was not John Connor.
You're right. He was Reese. Kyle Reese. I don't know why I thought that.
I'm sorry.
It's a mistake.
It's very upsetting.
It is upsetting. I apologize.
That's really weird that Rachel just corrected you on a Terminator reference.
Podcast over. That's it.
She's not nearly as familiar, I thought, but apparently she's way more familiar.
I have had to overcompensate on movie trivia since I was, you know, a small child, because tons of people were like, oh, you like movies? Name 30 facts about them. And so, yeah.
Did Derek do that to you about Terminator movies?
Derek has never been that person.
Thank you.
He only asked for 5 facts. What a sweetheart.
Nobody should have to prove that they're a fan of a fictional
fan. Okay, guys, we're getting
fandom.
Way off base here. Okay, fine. Let's reel it back in.
Fine. One other interesting note about the people behind the movie is the score, the music, was actually done by two people. But one of them was Hans Zimmer, who has gotten much more popular since The Rock. And basically, The Rock is him workshopping the entire soundtrack to Pirates of the Caribbean.
Now, that is all speculation, but yeah, it totally sounds like it, doesn't it?
Throughout the whole thing. Like, now I've got the Pirates of the Caribbean soundtrack stuck in my head because
easily.
Of this
yep.
movie.
So. Yeah. Easily.
Anyway, now to the real question. Nick Cage, best actor ever or worst actor ever?
Oh, my God.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean...
I mean, here's the deal. He at least knows what the movie is when nobody else does.
What does that mean, Ryan? What
you,
is
I
the
think
movie?
You know what that means. Like, none of us watched this movie were like, this is a good movie. I'm pretty sure, right? Like, I know you guys well enough to know that you aren't like, The Rock is a good movie.
It was pretty rough, man.
It was not good.
And, so wait, hang on. Had you seen this before?
I have, but it probably not since like the 90s. It's been a long time. I think I had it on VHS, but I don't ever remember watching it on VHS other than maybe once.
And Ray, this was your first viewing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, if we're talking specifically Nick Cage, his tone in the movie was the only one that was like he knew what was going on.
Like in the real world,
like,
or
like meta. Okay. Like he knew that he was in a bad movie and he embraced that and just like tried something. And he does this in a lot of his movies. I mean, really, if you go and watch a lot, especially his earlier movies, he tries something. He picks an accent or like a person that he wants to do the, or he, or like a super old film that he's inspired by or something, and he wants to do that in this movie, right? And even if it doesn't necessarily isn't what the director wants, he does it, and he commits to it the whole time. And I mean, he did that in this movie, and I was fine with it. I mean, there were parts of it where the writing for and everybody in the movie was just so bad that he was the only one that made it work, because he's used to doing movies with bad scripts. Even at this point in his career, he was used to doing movies with bad scripts. Whereas Sean Connery was like, was really trying hard to be straight with his delivery and things, but the writing was just so bad that he would stumble halfway through because he just couldn't figure out a way to say this that sounded right and natural. Did you guys get that vibe at all?
So I actually really enjoyed Connery. I thought he delivered things just a little bit differently than Nick Cage. Instead of going above and beyond in terms of like craziness, he went Shakespearean with everything. And that to me is a whole other side of cheesy, which I love. I love when really bad lines are said with like the gravitas of, you know, a 70-year-old stage actor. It's just ridiculous. So that to me, like, Connery was just amazing. He said some of the most ridiculous things, and I loved him for it.
I agree with you that I love when that's done. Like, when they actually, I just didn't feel like he pulled it off.
Oh, okay.
For me, it didn't. And admittedly, I'm not a Sean Connery fan. Ever since I heard some of the stuff that he's said in his personal life, I've never really been a fan of his. And, you know, I've seen any of his work, honestly. I've seen this, and I've seen Indiana Jones and The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, and that might be it. I don't remember much else from him. So, I mean, that might be tainting me. I don't know.
Well, separating the work from the artist in this case, I don't think he's a great actor. Like, just looking back at the movies I have seen, Highlander and Indiana Jones too, and First Night and League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, I don't believe he was anything special. I think that because he did Bond so often, he just kind of carried that throughout the rest of his whole career. And that's no way to live.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough because Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade is my favorite of the Indiana Jones movies. And I love the original three Indiana Jones movies. So I always really liked Sean Connery as a kid growing up. And so those characters, including this movie, kind of stuck with me. This movie came out in 96. I saw it on TV. So that would have been probably 98, I imagine. You know, I was like 11 or 12 when I first saw this movie, and I watched it a lot on TV. I think it's a fun movie. It's clearly not written well, and there are Michael Bay-esque things in it that I don't like, like the insane car chase with giant explosions and things like that. Right? And you know, those are Michael Bay tropes that I wish weren't in it. But I like a lot of this movie. I think it's silly 90s fun that for some reason that decade was able to get away with that hasn't really happened before or since in a successful way. But I think it works as a 90s action film. And other than the first Bad Boys, is probably Michael Bay's best movie.
Armageddon, please. Come on.
I love Armageddon, but Armageddon is at least as poorly written and silly as this. Minimum.
I can see that.
It has a better cast.
I think it's cut a bit better too. If I am going to be critical of this movie and not just like go all in on the silliness, this movie could be cut down by about half an hour. Like, there is a lot of filler. There's a lot of excess that does nothing for the story. It does nothing for the action scenes either. My biggest takeaway is why, and I mentioned this to Derek last night when we were watching it, what in the world, why did Michael Bay not get approached to do the Fast and Furious series? Cheesy dialogue, things focusing on family and family getting torn apart, and then insane car chases and explosions. Like, that's right up his alley.
I think it's because they actually wanted women in the movie. In the Fast and the Furious movie.
In the 90s, they didn't, like, he did not hire women. He just didn't. And
it was horrible. Like, in this movie, it was felt. I told my girlfriend that I was watching it with partway through, I was like, man, how much better would this have been if, like, one of the teams had some female character or both? Because right now, it's just testosterone on testosterone on testosterone. And just a super badass, she doesn't even have to be super feminine chick would, you know, bring this, and I say chick in a loving way. I'm sorry. I'm really bad about using that term.
I love chick.
Bringing a woman into that would really have changed up the dynamic in a much better way, I think. Really trying to be critical about it. Having just men everywhere was not a good dynamic. There was two women in this movie, I think, and that was basically it.
Two? I can only think of one.
Yeah, there was Connery's daughter and Nick Cage's girlfriend. Well, fiance, whatever.
Yeah. I forgot about the daughter.
It was incredibly glaring. I felt it too. I absolutely hated it. It was a bummer. It really was. And
it's never hit me in a movie. I don't know if it's just you influencing me or not. In either way, I'm thankful for it. But it really, like, was so obvious in this. I've never watched a movie where I was like, oh my gosh, this is real bad. There's no women in this. What the heck? And the people trying to appeal to, I assume, are men, because traditionally men are more into action movies. So, you know, you think throwing some women in there would probably be a good idea.
Right. So I think this constantly. When straight guys bitch a ton about women leads, I get so confused, you know, like, what is happening? Are you sure you like women? Are you sure?
I think some of it has to do with the generation of the man and when, you know, cause like me and Derek, were, you know, born in the 80s, grew up in the 90s when it was action movies were men and really muscly men in tight or no shirts. And that was like the epitome of action for us. And, you know, I can't speak for Derek, but even now, like, I still think the male form is really impressive at its most muscular. And seeing an action movie with super muscular dudes is still a super awesome action movie for me. Now, I can appreciate awesome women also, but I think that more modern moviegoers have a probably different vision of action movies and what they want from them than
doesn't have like muscly strong guys. You've got Ed Harris, who's, you know, clearly a strategic military mind, but he's a lean dude. You've got Nicolas Cage, who's, you know, a desk jockey, and then an 83-year-old inmate.
For me, the action was mediocre in this movie, honestly. Like, and this was something I wanted to bring up since you brought up the car chase and stuff. This seemed like it was Michael Bay, like, testing out how he was going to be Michael Bay. Like, what was going to be his thing. Because the car chase, he does great car chases. You've seen Bad Boys. You've seen Bad Boys 2. You've seen a lot of his other movies. He almost always has a really great car chase in the movie. But in this movie, that car chase was bad. It was boring. It was, you know, the Ferrari. He had a Ferrari, which he has in a lot of his movies. You know, Bad Boys has some great chase scenes with Ferraris, but like, it didn't do anything except hit stuff and like fishtail a little bit. It wasn't even there for like 80% of the chase scene.
Yeah, well, keep in mind, so Bad Boys was right before this.
Right, but they probably filmed at the same, not at the same time, but like, I don't know, maybe he filmed this movie first and it took longer in editing or something. But
I mean, this is a Disney film. Maybe that had something to do with it.
It maybe does. If this one felt more like a film where he's trying to figure out what his style is going to be than Bad Boys, it's, you know, Bad Boys was basically better on every level for me.
I mean, pretty much. And I was going to say, I mean, except for the ratio of men to women, because in Bad Boys, the first one anyway, there's one woman character of any real substance. And then the rest are really just there as eye candy for the men characters. Right. And so like that movie doesn't really do any better, in my opinion.
For the win. And, yeah. You're right. And yeah. He's had traditionally a lot of bad press come out about the way he treats women on his sets too. So, I mean, you know, Megan Fox came out and said some pretty terrible stuff about him. And he said some pretty terrible stuff about, I think she compared him to Hitler at one mm-hmm. point. Or called him
Spielberg,
a Nazi or
yes.
something.
Spielberg told him to fire her immediately.
Yeah. So, I mean,
yeah, it's not a great, like, I am not defending Michael Bay at all, but like, I can't believe that he's really that bad, so don't say it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to defend him, or I guess I'm not going to defend her use of comparing him to Hitler, but for real, it's very obvious how he sees women. Michael Bay is perpetuating the women are objects.
Yeah, I see. I kind of put Michael Bay in the same category in terms of director, not like what he does for women or anything like that. And with Zack Snyder, right? Like they're very specific things that they do extremely well. You know, Zack Snyder, his visuals are unparalleled. He's a shit storyteller, though. Like he's unless the story is written for him, like he has a story on paper that's already proven to be good, it's bad. But Michael Bay does really good action usually. But this movie had action that made me want to pull out my phone and browse Facebook because it was so bad. And
well, that might be why he's kind of just been the Transformers guy. I mean, if you look at his directing resume, you know, forget producing for a minute. If you look just his directing resume, since the first Transformers movie in 2007, you know, he's done 5 Transformers movies and only 3 other movies.
And he produced the Ninja Turtles movies, right? Not directed. Yeah,
correct. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he did Pain and Gain, 13 Hours, and 6 Underground, which was a straight-to-Netflix thing that's been pretty well panned. Those are the only non-Transformers movies he's done in the last 13 years.
And I mean, rightfully so. I think, you know, he peaked in the 90s, and the Transformers movies were not popular because of his directing skill. I mean, any of us that have seen those can understand why those movies were popular. Yeah. And it was not anything to do with him.
Well, that might be the key is like, if you look, his first 3 movies are Bad Boys, The Rock, and Armageddon. Those are his 3 best directed movies. In my opinion.
Sure.
Do you think something's better? What do you like that he directed?
Nothing.
Oh, okay. So you're just okay. All right. Well, this is not the Michael Bay podcast. So let's talk a bit more about the movie.
To be honest, I forgot that he directed this until I saw it pop up on the screen. So
fair enough. So, okay. Let's talk story for a minute. Let's talk the plot, right? So the plot here, of course, is that covert operations, top secret classified operations where military people die. Their families are not paid out. The fallen soldiers are not given a proper burial or you know, recognition, medals, all those types of things. The families aren't given the financial support they're normally supposed to receive. And Ed Harris and his group of soldiers, they're all supposed to be Navy SEALs, have decided to take it upon themselves to essentially extort $100 million from the U.S. government to give to all of those families and then themselves. And they're going to do it using the worst chemical weapon that's ever been known to exist on San Francisco.
Yes.
That is the plot.
That is the mm-hmm. plot to the movie.
You got and it. Good job.
In order to save the day, a bomb diffuser, Nick Cage, has to team up with the Alcatraz escaping convict of Sean Connery.
That was the biggest stretch for me. I feel like Nick Cage was in the wrong role, to be completely honest. I have zero issue with him being the hero. I have a ton of issue with him trying to convince me he's a biochemist this entire time.
Really?
Yes.
Why didn't that work for you?
Come on.
Because like, he's been too many, she's seen too many other Nick Cage movies where he's the hero, probably, and so it's hard to see him. And I had some of the same trouble.
But he's been something different. Like
I'm speaking for you.
It's just not really believable that he is a biochemist. Like, I would have believed it if it was the other way around. If he was the dangerous criminal that escaped Alcatraz and Sean Connery was the biochemist. That makes way more sense to me. I just believe Sean Connery to be a smarter person in general than Nick Cage.
It's the accent.
To be fair, they do portray him as a smarter character.
No, they portray him as a more seasoned character.
He's pretty freaking intelligent. Like,
he is.
Nick Cage
knows. But Nick Cage matches everything that he knows in terms of like book knowledge, not talking. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah, but then also he knows everything about these chemicals on top of that. So,
yeah. All right. So there's.
Yeah, like I can definitely. Rachel, I felt similar. I kind of got over it once he started like growing a pair, for lack of a better term. Like when he started like actually doing things and kind of got more into an action hero type mindset, you know, where he was like the last one left or whatever and had to do this stuff. Right. It was a little better then, but yeah, it was a little weird at first. Also, like they start right away with like establishing that he's a Beatles fan, a huge Beatles fan. And I was like, man, I can't wait to see where this pays off.
Does it?
Never pays off, except for there's a scene where he's like listening to a record and naked and strumming a guitar.
Yeah, see, the beginning was really good. I actually liked the Beatles. I liked the moment where they're dealing with the, I guess, delivery from the Serbian.
Yeah, I liked that scene too. That was a cool scene.
And him and his girlfriend discussing everything in their apartment was really cool. And that's when it stopped.
See, like, it's speaking of the Beatles thing, it's funny because at the end of the movie, when he does make a music reference, it's to Elton John.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not even a Beatles song.
Yeah, and it was such a poorly set up. It's like, of course, the bad guy's going to stand directly in front of the giant rocket that actually has a rocket loaded into it. For like a minute and a half, he's standing in front of it. And the guy's standing next to the launch button. He didn't at any point think, oh, maybe I should just like take a step, one step to either direction. And then I'll be safe.
Especially since up until this point, while these soldiers are clearly bad guys, none of them are not intelligent.
Right. They're all very well trained, highly trained, you know, soldiers. Yeah.
Right. They're some of the best we had to offer, right. You know, so that it makes it even less believable. You know, he's not just some hired thug, you know.
The action, again, was not great in this movie. And it was disappointing. When I saw Michael Bay was directing it, I thought maybe this is going to be better than I remember it. No. And it was incredibly obvious that at some point in the movie, one of those little green balls was going to be used as a weapon.
Oh,
that,
sure.
Yeah.
Ever since I saw the first one, I was like, oh, somebody's going to do something with one of these for sure. This is not just going to be like a plot device.
No.
They're too easily breakable. Right. And throwable for somebody to be able to not use this as a weapon at some point in the movie. Now, I didn't necessarily pick that somebody was going to be eating one.
That was intense.
That was nasty. Yeah.
But that was a good way of doing it because I think everyone guessed that it was going to happen. But the how, I think they were still able to surprise a bit.
Yeah.
And I appreciated that.
So we never really caught up or said anything about this. Did you guys... Well, I guess Rachel said she didn't really love Nick Cage in this. Derek, how did you feel about Nick Cage in this?
I like him and Sean Connery together. I think they make a really weird team that somehow works for me in this tone of a film, right? And it depends how you go into it. Like, I don't take these movies seriously at all. And so I have a lot of fun with them. I think that they're definitely silly. There are some lines in this movie that are just not good lines, and lines that are supposed to be super serious. You know, like there's at the very end of the movie, right as like the fighter jets are about to launch, you know, and what's his name's like, you know, the God help us line that every action movie like this has to have.
This was so cheesy. Like, is this where tropes were born? Or
I think Nicolas Cage movies are where tropes are born. I don't know.
That was so crazy. The may God have mercy on your soul.
That's the line. Thank you.
Oh my God.
What about the prom queen line? Did you guys?
Yes. Okay? What?
It like, makes me laugh.
First of all, I actually really liked Nick Cage and Sean Connery together because I think they had really good chemistry.
I thought they had no chemistry. I don't know where you guys are coming from with this. I got nothing from them.
Oh, no, man. They had more chemistry than Nick Cage and his girlfriend.
That's true. They also had no chemistry.
To see Sean Connery and Nick Cage have sex.
That would have been a much different movie for sure.
It would have, yeah. But I think he could still have done it. Like,
well... I mean, Nick Cage would have done it for sure.
I definitely like the two of them so much so that, like, I'm still a little disappointed that we never got a sequel.
Okay.
I mean, look, Michael Bay had an idea for a sequel. It just never happened for a lot of reasons, I'm sure. But I would have been interested to see that because I think the two of them on an adventure together was a lot of fun.
All right.
Especially because in the sequel, you know, they would have been on, you know, for sure on the same side, you know?
Yeah.
I thought it would have been cute.
Okay. We love you, Derek.
I would have liked it. So what did you guys think of Ed Harris and his character throughout the movie? Because, you know, he's the big bad who has a change of heart and chooses not to be the big bad.
Ed Harris is always great. Like, I don't know. I don't know a lot about him as an actor, but a lot of them, basically all the movies I think that I've seen him in, he's been a good part of it. Like he's, I can't really ever think of a performance where I could complain about him, but yeah, I mean, it was at the beginning, it was like, okay, so he's going to get the money for the soldiers' families by killing like a whole bunch of innocent people that didn't do anything. And now they're going to die. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah,
and then that was he wasn't planning on doing it the whole time, and so you know, that made more sense to me that because he's supposed to be a smart tactician and everything else, and he just didn't bank on them calling his bluff, and you know, it was fine. Ed Harris was good, but the character, I don't know, it was better than most of the other characters in the movie, I guess, but still not great.
Ed Harris serves a purpose in every movie he's in, and it's the exact same purpose, to be kind of a hard ass, kind of the straight man. He is supposed to blend in. Nobody remembers Ed Harris once you like turn off the movie, unfortunately. He doesn't stick out as a memorable part of things. He's there and he serves his purpose and he does it really well, but he's just not there to, you know, stick out, I guess.
Yeah, that's fair. And you know, I think the problem with his character's arc, if that's what you can call it, in this is if it was really a bluff the whole time and he really had no intentions of killing 70-ish thousand civilians, then why did he enlist people who clearly had no idea that this was a bluff?
Also, why did he tell them in the very beginning that he was at Alcatraz? He told the government that. This whole movie could have been much different if he just was like, hey guys, I'm at Alcatraz. They would have no idea where he's at.
Absolutely. He could have lied and said he was at anywhere.
Yeah.
And they would have gone there instead and wasted all this time. And
yeah. It's like he wanted his guys to die.
Well, he wanted the recognition. I think that's the key, is he wanted it on display, you know, and he wanted to prove that he could cause the damage that they were claiming. Because if he doesn't say where he is, maybe they won't take him seriously as being able to hit San Francisco. Right. So
when
like
he launches a missile.
That, but he doesn't want to do that, right? That's where the problem comes in, is that the whole thing is a bluff, and that kind of makes the rest of it confusing, you know? Because like these guys that he picked, like the major aside, the rest of these guys are like bad dudes. These are people who like wanted to be mercenaries at the first chance they could possibly get.
Well,
at least that's how they're played.
There's two sets. There's, you know, the ones that include Ed Harris and John C. McGinley, and they're just trying to help out vets' families. And then there's the Tony Todd group of people who are, who become the mercenaries. And Unfortunately, more of the Tony Todd group of people end up, you know, lasting longer.
Yeah, but both groups just murder a bunch of active military people.
Oh, they do. Yeah, they're terrible people. Yeah.
You know, so like, it's hard for me to even see any difference between any of them. I mean, at least like Ed Harris doesn't pull a trigger until the standoff towards the end of the movie. Up until that point, he hasn't shot a single person, right? Like directly. He's of course called all of the orders, almost all of the orders. I guess the big fight in the bathroom, he didn't give permission to fire, but you know, everybody else is like looking for an opportunity to kill somebody.
Yeah.
You know, like even John C. McGinley's character doesn't seem to hesitate at an opportunity to kill people.
Right. No, you're definitely right.
In the beginning, when Nick Cage's character finds out his girlfriend is pregnant, and then mid-sex, he finds out that he's going to Los Angeles or wherever the fuck this thing took place.
San Francisco?
Yeah, San Francisco, that one. They're all the same. It's all California. Anyway. he's like, why don't you come? You can order champagne. And he's talking about like you're totally pregnant, but hey, order a bunch of champagne that you can't drink. I said that
too.
Yeah, I didn't notice that, but my girlfriend brought it up and I thought that was pretty funny. No?
No, it was definitely funny.
It was like, come on, man. Like you're supposed to be this genius. Yeah. That was a weird sex scene. Kind of out of place, really. Like they just found out that she's pregnant and now they're just like, let's bang one out.
Yeah, that scene is, it's weird. Their whole relationship is weird. Like you said earlier, they have like no chemistry and it just doesn't really work for me at all, you know. But
when all the scenes where she's like in with the government and they're waiting to find out if he's alive, I'm like I don't really care, because she doesn't seem to really care that much, and like, so there's no gravity in any of these scenes, so
why is she hugging them?
Yeah, that was weird too.
Well, that's got to be a Michael Bay thing, right? Because she's, you know, the sad poor woman who doesn't, you know, hopes her man isn't dead or some nonsense, you know.
Yeah, I guess,
because like, I, we don't know anything about her.
Nope, other than she's pregnant. She can carry a baby and have sex with Nick Cage.
Well, can you say that, Ryan?
I cannot, unfortunately. Not yet, anyway.
It's good to have still balls. Time. Yeah. So, all right. What else is there to touch on? Is there anything else in this movie you think is worth mentioning, either good or bad? Either way is fine.
So once you get to, once you get past the shower scene, the deaths become absolutely ridiculous and over the top, and it's so bad that it's great. Like, it goes above and beyond, and I love that.
That's good. Okay, like Tony Todd's death.
Tony Todd, John C. McGinley's, the showdown between the five guys. Mm. Yeah.
Gotcha. I have a complaint.
Yeah.
So early on in the movie, when they're trying to get onto the island and all this other stuff, like every 5 seconds they cut to the FBI director who's like, damn it, I knew it, he ran, talking about like Sean Connery, and then Sean Connery is still there, and it's like over and over again to the point of it just being annoying.
Yeah, he's super one-dimensional. Like his entire character just exists to hate Sean Connery's character.
Yeah.
And there's nothing to it. There's no building of that. There's no exploring it. It's just, this dude kept Sean Connery in jail for a really long time, and he's pissy that he's not in jail right now.
Well, the first like hour and 10 minutes of this movie is like 99% exposition.
Most of it.
It's so bad. And the movie's called The Rock, and you don't even really see The Rock or have any action on The Rock until over an hour into the movie.
Yeah.
You see this, the like special forces team or whatever go in there, but beyond that, they don't even like start heading to Alcatraz for over an hour.
Yeah.
It's At a certain point, I hit the button to see how far into the movie we were, and I was like, "We're still not at the rock yet. What is this? I want my money back."
I do like the balcony scene though. After he gets his haircut,
yeah,
where he throws the FBI director off the side.
The haircut scene, and right after it is really good. It's like really that. Funny.
I think that the hairdresser was like the highlight of the movie. Really, he's just like, I just want you to be happy with your hair. That was a dude that just took pride in his job. It was really enthusiastic about doing the best job he could. And I don't know that I can say that about any other actor in this movie.
But did he even get an answer? The poor guy.
No,
did not.
Sean Connery like the hair?
That actor did end up getting his own series after this. Did he? Yes.
Thank God. He deserved it.
Like a series like about The Rock or...
Yeah, it was a continuation of his character from The Rock.
No, it was not. That would have been fantastic, though.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, man. All right. Well, I think that's probably all there is to say about The Rock at this point. You know, I don't think it's terrible. I don't think it's amazing. I think it's just kind of fun to watch. I like the Sean Connery and Nick Cage characters. Any final thoughts from you guys?
I'm glad Nick Cage was in this. Otherwise, I would have probably been on my phone more.
Well, I picked it because Nick Cage was in it just for you.
It's kind of sad that he's playing second fiddle to Sean Connery, but, you know, he kind of steals it.
I mean, he's in the movie a lot more than Sean Connery is.
Yeah, but Sean Connery's like supposed to be this awesome badass like super thing, and Nick Cage is like this bumbling scientist. So I don't know. He's not the action star of the movie.
Not till the end. I mean, he definitely comes into his own.
He picks it up later. Yeah.
I mean, come on, when he fights Captain Fry, like it's a pretty good sequence.
Yeah, it's not too bad. It's one of the better ones in the movie.
I think so. Ray, any final thoughts?
No, not really. Okay. Not really at all. Like I tried
She'll
to say
never think about it again after this podcast is over.
That's probably very true. I said all the things that I was positive with, so I want to just sit there and be like, I'm tired of you guys always making me watch shitty films.
Hey, wow. Surf Ninjas wasn't shitty.
Wow.
Leslie Nielsen was great in it.
We have all picked movies to talk about on this show that aren't good.
No, you're totally right. I just like giving you shit.
Let's be fair. All right. Well, then that's going to be it for us this week. We will, of course, be back next week. And next week, we're talking about... we're doing Jonah Hex, the DC film Jonah Hex, which is available on HBO Max to stream. Ray, do you want to explain to people why we're going to be discussing Jonah Hex?
All right.
We hate ourselves.
So, if you have not joined our Screen Heroes podcast forum on Facebook, it's our little group. We've been doing brackets all year round just to kind of get through COVID and be kind of fun and productive each day. Well, our current one is the best DC casting. It's for live action movies that hit theaters, produced by DC and Warner Brothers. So it'll include all the DCEU, but it also includes some of the more ridiculous ones like Jonah Hex, like Catwoman, and V for Vendetta, Watchmen, Steel, that kind of thing. Of course, starting out, a bracket always has kind of your worst against your best. So Jonah Hex will be in the bracket probably next week. So, this will be commemorating it just a bit.
Awesome. Sweet. Sounds good. Well, join our group. Make sure you join us, Screen Heroes Podcast Forum on Facebook. You can join us, Screen Heroes Podcast Forum, and vote and all that goodness. And you can join us live Tuesday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 Central, and chat with us during the show. Thank you to those of you who did join us tonight. We appreciate your comments in chat, so thank you for that. Otherwise, we are the Screen Heroes Podcast on the Heroes Podcast Network. You can find us at Screen Heroes Pod on Twitter or heroespodcast.com. The show is available on your podcast app of choice, including Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Podcast Addict, and more. You can find Ryan at Buster Props. Ray is at Siren Ray, and I am at the Star Trek Dude. Thanks for listening. We will catch you next week.